From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Nestled in the NFL standings just below the world-beating Cowboys, Packers, Colts, and Patriots are the tolerable Titans, boilerplate Broncos, so-so Saints, colorless Cardinals, vanilla Vikings, and typical Texans, among others. So why are some saying that the NFL is out of whack? Ahead on Only a Game, a fully sufficient look at NFL parity. Also, the best American sports writing of 2007. Also ahead, the one-man play about boxing champ and Shakespeare scholar Gene Tunney.
I'm nervous that if they don't like what I say about Tunney, that I might actually, you know, a lukewarm applause is something that I can deal with, but I'm not sure about meeting somebody at the stage door who wants to take me in the ring.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Not so long ago, the National Football League's slogan of choice was "On Any Given Sunday." The intent behind the phrase was to snooker fans of bad to mediocre football teams into watching those teams play. The contention was that through their salary cap restrictions and the annual draft that gives the least successful teams the opportunity to pick the top college players, the NFL had been so successful in achieving parity that any team really could beat any other team on any given Sunday. Among those still using the phrase is Jim Armstrong, columnist for the Denver Post.
Well, it's a cliche, and I like to march it out now and then. You know, I got space to fill in the newspaper, too. It's true, though.
Well, yeah, on any given Sunday is true, sort of, except that the NFL plays games on Monday night, too, and Saturday sometimes, and then there are those Thursday games. But parity? Sure. The Broncos, about whom Jim Armstrong writes, have won 5 games and lost 6. The number of teams that have either done that or won 6 games and lost 5 is 12. Add in the clubs that are 7-4 or 4-7, and you get 20, a statistic that leads CBS Sportsline writer Ray Ratto to conclude that the league's strategy still works.
Parity isn't dead. If you look at the bottom end, there's about 10 or 12 teams that are hard to watch. Then there's a bunch more teams in the middle. You usually don't get 4 teams with exceptional records. You usually might get 1 or 2. But, you know, it's the great middle that they're after, and the great middle is still there in force.
The problem comes when one of those teams Ray Ratto has identified as hard to watch plays one of the exceptionally good teams, the undefeated Patriots, certainly, or the Colts, the Cowboys, or the Packers. But Ray Ratto has noticed that those matchups appeal to football fans for reasons that have nothing to do with suspense.
This year, they're also finding out that people get an odd charge out of watching a team try to run the table. And because the Patriots not only are in the process of running the table, but they're doing it by such considerable margins that people are finding that fascinating. Maybe next year's slogan is, on any given Sunday, you can watch a team win 56-10.
One of those 56-10 games may be available to Baltimore Ravens fans on Monday night, whether they like it or not. The 4-7 Ravens will host the 11-0 Patriots. Rick Mace of the Baltimore Sun has already run the numbers.
We do predictions in my newspaper, and I believe the score I predicted was 70-3, but I might have predicted the Ravens score 7. I don't remember. But I definitely got the Patriots covering the spread.
That's a potentially risky prediction. The Pats only beat the Philadelphia Eagles by 3 points last weekend. The spread was an unprecedented 24.5. If you took the Eagles and the points, you won. By a lot. On the other hand, the Pats did win the game, which, according to Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Ashley Fox, did not entirely dismay her.
I think fans pretty much want their team to be New England.
To be New England.
To be New England, sure. I mean, who wouldn't want their team to be 11-0 and bludgeoning opponent after opponent? I'm not a fan of anyone, but I like to see total, sheer, utter dominance.
Ms. Fox's personal preferences aside, dominance by one or even a couple of teams is not what the NFL is supposed to be about. And though the undefeated Patriots have won 3 Super Bowls since 2002, Denver Post writer Jim Armstrong cites history in his argument that in pro football, the preservation of an overwhelmingly successful team, like ongoing total ineptitude, is unlikely.
For everybody to be 8-8. I mean, they reward the teams that go 2-14 or 3-13, they get rewarded.
They get the first pick in the draft. They get the next Peyton Manning. In the last 6 or 8 years, we've seen the Rams go from 4-12 to winning a Super Bowl. We've seen the Cleveland Browns this year. They're the classic example. They look like this hopeless outfit, just hadn't found their way. The next thing you know, they hit on a couple of draft choices, a couple of their veterans get healthy, and the Browns are a viable playoff team. So you just never know what today's NFL.
Maybe so. Tomorrow, for example, the 2-9 New York Jets face the 0-11 Dolphins. Those numbers would suggest that the Jets should be favored. I mean, they have won twice. On the other hand, the game is in Miami, so the Dolphins will have the home field advantage, assuming anybody shows up to watch. So maybe on the board in Las Vegas, the game is even, though this is perhaps not the sort of parity the people running the NFL had in mind. Talking heads, hot stove leaguers, sabermetricians, and boys without girlfriends will all pay attention to what happens in Nashville next week as the Music City will host baseball's annual winter meetings. With the shelves of the free agent market more or less bare, the dealing between teams this year could be more intense than ever. Joining me on the line to speculate on what will happen is Tim Kirkchen of ESPN. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. The race to acquire Minnesota's Johan Santana, arguably the best pitcher in baseball, is the biggest story heading into next week. Do you have any idea where he's going to wind up?
I don't think anyone does for sure, Bill, but this makes sense that he would go to the Yankees, and here's why. The Yankees, as always, have the most money, and that's going to be very important because Santana is going to be looking at roughly $130 million over 6 or 7 or 8 years around that area. They also have young players that they're very interested in Minnesota, including Phil Hughes, a pitcher, maybe Melky Cabrera, and maybe some other guys. And also they have Hank Steinbrenner in charge now, and Hank Steinbrenner, son of George, seems to be taking a much more active role than anyone else in that organization, and he appears to be a lot like his younger dad, who used to say, all right, I got to have this guy, and he doesn't rest until he gets them. All of those suggest that I think Johan Santana is going to end up with the Yankees, but you can't count the Red Sox out, although I don't think it's likely. I know the Mets are really, really hot after him. However, I don't think they have the people in place to get Santana from the Twins.
Tim, it's been a while since we've talked about the always intriguing plight of the small market team, but while the impending Santana deal would be great for whatever large market team got him, would it be bad for baseball?
Well, I don't think it's good for baseball. When a pitcher comes up through an organization like this, they develop him, they pay him, they make him into the pitcher that he is, and then after 6 years of that, he says, I'm going to the highest bidder. That is never a good situation for baseball. But it has been like that for 30 years now, if not more. And people had better get used to the fact that it is going to remain that way. We have seen some smaller market teams spending a little bit more money, but it's very rare that we find a small market team that can hold on to the very best players, and that's why Santana, Miguel Cabrera are the two best players out there because they play for small market teams, and those teams simply cannot afford them.
So baseball's record $6.1 billion intake this year doesn't change the fact that there remains a huge gap between the haves and the have-mores.
Right, and I don't think that gap's going to change anytime soon. Now, clearly, revenue sharing is helping. Clearly, the money that the Yankees are giving to the Royals and other teams are starting to help those teams, but they need certainly more help than this. I must say the small market teams have stopped feeling sorry for themselves and are doing more to get better, and that's a good sign.
The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim of the Ronald Reagan Federal Building and Courthouse with the palm trees out front have already acquired outfielder Torii Hunter from the Twins, and they appear to be the front runner to nab third baseman Miguel Cabrera from the Florida Marlins. Will that be enough for the Angels to finally beat the Red Sox in the playoffs?
Well, I think if they get Cabrera without gutting too much of their team, I think they have a real chance because if you put Cabrera in the middle of that order, that is the one thing they had to have was another big bat. You pair him up with Vladimir Guerrero, you have something close to, if not even better than, a Manny Ramirez-David Ortiz situation. Clearly, the Angels learned last year that it's just not good enough to make the playoffs and get knocked out in the first round by the Red Sox again. They have to do something. They overpaid for Torii Hunter, but unfortunately, that's what teams do these days. I think they made a good trade for John Garland, and the bottom line is they are not done dealing. I think they are the leader for Cabrera, and there's just no way that Artie Moreno, their very aggressive owner, is going to leave the winter meetings or enter next season without even a better team than he has right now.
Artie Moreno made other news this week, Tim, when he claimed the forthcoming Mitchell report on performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball will include the names of specific players. How would Moreno have information nobody else has, or is he just trying to get attention?
Well, I don't think he's going for attention, but he may be the only one who's actually spoken up. I mean, people have been, you know, leaking that, you know, what's going to be in the Mitchell report. It's possible Artie Moreno's absolutely right. And I think ultimately he's going to be right. I know the union is fighting to have the names kept out, which of course they would. But I just can't imagine George Mitchell's group spending this kind of money and this kind of time and just telling us, hey, we had a big problem in baseball and we're starting to clear it up and here's how we're going to prevent it in the future without laying down some names. I think Artie Moreno is going to be right. Exactly where his source comes from, who knows, but it's doubtful that a responsible owner such as himself would say something without having it backed up.
Barry Bonds will be arraigned next Friday for perjury and obstruction of justice charges. Are you hoping that he pleads guilty and spares everybody weeks of courtroom drama?
Yes, I'm hoping for baseball's sake and for all of our sake, basically, that we just get this chapter over with and start to move on so we can talk more about the game as opposed to the off-the-field stuff. But I can't imagine Barry Bonds pleading guilty to anything at this point. And maybe he'll realize, possibly, that the Fed's case is so strong that this is his only choice. But my guess is, knowing Barry Bonds the way that most people do, which, by the way, isn't very well, he's going to fight it because that's what he does. He doesn't want anybody telling him what to do. He wants to set the stage his way. And I don't see him pleading guilty, but that's what we're going to learn in 10 days or so.
Game of Shadows, the book that details Barry Bonds' steroid use and talks about the rest of the Balco scandal, will be made into a movie by HBO. Will you gather the Kirkchin family around the hearth for the premiere?
Well, first I have to sign up for HBO, and then if I do, I think we're going to leave the Kirkchin children somewhere to watch SpongeBob SquarePants or something else. Because I'm not sure they should be watching this. Just because they're impressionable kids, 16 and 14, and they're old enough to understand. But I just don't know who they're going to get to play Barry Bonds in the movie. I'm not sure there's anyone big enough to do that, physically.
Tim Kirkchin covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Pigeon fanciers throughout England are petitioning Queen Elizabeth in an attempt to get their passion classified as a sport, a distinction that the racing of pigeons has not previously enjoyed. Their motivation is the recent determination of the British government to tax the sheds in which pigeons live. If the government were to recognize pigeon racing as a sport, the people who own the birds would be eligible for tax relief. Otherwise, according to Eric Sim of the Royal Pigeon Racing Association, the game might be up. Even if it's not officially classified a sport, Sim said, pigeon racing has been recognized as a sport for well over 100 years, and this latest turn of events will cause many clubs to struggle to make ends meet. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the best American sports writing of 2007. But first, the University of Hawaii's football team is currently ranked number 12 in the nation, and they are this year's Western Athletic Conference champion by virtue of their 39-27 win over Boise State last week. Here to discuss Warriors football, Hakka dances, and a Heisman hopeful named Colt Brennan is Stephen Tsai, who covers the team for the Honolulu Advertiser. He joins me on the line from Honolulu. Stephen, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Today's game against Washington will take place at Aloha Stadium. How are football fans in Hawaii reacting to their team's unprecedented success?
Well, it's the only football team in town, major team. It's actually one of the only major events in town, and that really rallies the state. Say if you live in Boise, not all of Idaho is behind you, but if you're playing for Hawaii football team, the entire state's behind you. So they're representing a state that's very isolated, and people just want a little bit more respect from people from the mainland, as we call it, and I think that's why it's a really important game for Hawaii, not just for the football team, but for the state to just show that it, deserves to be recognized.
So respect thy name is getting into a BCS bowl game, right? If they win, that's what happens.
Yeah, it hasn't been easy. The athletic director hasn't really been doing his job, and the schedule is really weak, and it was weakest schedule among the Division I-A teams in the country. Mm. So it is a very good team, but we don't really know because it's not playing a schedule to show how good it is.
I understand that after last week's win over Boise State, several of the players found that their helmets had been snatched. Have they been returned?
Yes, they have been, and it's one of those things where they put out a plea, please return the helmets. And when you take something like this, what you want to do is you want to brag, but there's been such shame put on people who have taken it. They can't brag. You can't say, I've got this helmet, They have to give it back, and it's been coming back in, pieces and stuff like that, and it hasn't been one of those things where they cut off a little ear flap or something and just sent it in to show that they have it. It's people just been dropping it off. It's pretty nice. It's Aloha Stadium. It's the Aloha State. That's what we do here.
I think my favorite story out of that whole event was the one player who said, I love my helmet. I really want it back. But in fact, it takes a long time to break in a helmet. There are some number of players that would have been pretty uncomfortable wearing brand new helmets in their last game of the season.
Right, and first of all, you shouldn't really be losing your helmet. That's like a police officer losing his badge. But yes, it does take a while to break it in, and they equated it to breaking a new jock, but I just don't see how that's the same. It's a little bit different.
I suppose it would be. Hawaii obviously is a unique place with a unique culture, but tell me a little bit about the culture that's particular to Hawaii football.
I think they lead the league or the nation in longest hair, because everyone has long hair on the team, mm-hmm. and it's sort of a source of pride there. It has a lot to do with the Polynesian culture here, and that's why they also lead the league in tattoos, which is probably why this team can't donate blood for several years, because they keep adding new tattoos. And also they borrowed a chant dance from the Maori people called the Hakka. Mm. And they performed it before last year's games, and this year they've created their own style. It's called the Ha'a.
The Ha'a?
It's basing a lot of Polynesian and Hawaiian words and themes into this dance, and they perform before the games, and they perform it after the games, win or lose.
Perhaps you should describe what it looks like when some large, long-haired men perform this dance.
It's quite intimidating. In fact, they've been penalized once before a game for performing it during warm-ups, and that's probably got to be the first unsportsmanlike conduct penalty before a game, but a lot of big eyes, a lot of big movements, and a lot of loud voices. In fact, there's this the leader, his name is Brad Kalilimoku. He's a linebacker, and he sort of has a soft, gentle voice, but when it's time to do the ha-ha, they mic him up, and he turns into the Hulk. It's an incredible metamorphosis.
Hawaii quarterback Colt Brennan has been mentioned as a possible Heisman candidate. What has he done to merit that sort of consideration?
Well, last year he had the best statistical season in the history of the NCAA. He had complete about 74% of his passes, but the main thing is he throws a lot. If you throw a lot, normally you don't have a great completion ratio, but he had an incredible one last year, and he's just a very accurate quarterback, and he's quite a lovable guy here. And if he were old enough, he'd probably be governor.
The Warriors played in the Hawaii Bowl last year, which must have been extremely comfortable for them. But should they win today and make a BCS bowl game, will anybody feel disappointed that they'll travel from Hawaii to play it?
No, you're right. They'll love going to Hawaii, and I suppose if they would win, the favorite would be the Sugar Bowl. And I think everyone's getting ready for some Cajun food. And also the Reporters Gone Wild video that we were planning to shoot.
Stephen Tsai covers the University of Hawaii Warriors for the Honolulu Advertiser, and he joined me on the line from Honolulu. Thank you very much for talking with me, Stephen.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
The Best American Sports Writing 2007 is on the shelves. Glenn Stout has been the series editor responsible for this annual collection of exceptional writing concerned in one way or another with our games since the volume's inception in 1991. This edition's guest editor is David Marinus. I'm delighted that both are joining me now. Glenn from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Colchester, Vermont. Glenn, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And David from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. David, it's nice to have the opportunity to talk to you again as well.
Great, Bill.
Well, I look forward to seeing Best American Sports Writing each fall because I know that I'm going to see excellent stories that I've missed over the course of the year. Glenn, I'm wondering if part of your job is rescuing articles that might otherwise have been lost.
Well, I really feel that. I mean, none of us can read everything, and I try to read a lot, but I certainly can't read everything, and that's where I depend on people to send me stories, and that's where the real surprises come up, or when I stumble across something in a publication or even a website that, you know, many people might not know about. I really do feel a responsibility sometimes to, you know, hold that piece of work up and start screaming, hey, you've got to read this. because quite frankly, you know, if things are not collected in books like this, for all intents and purposes, they do disappear. You know, you rarely stumble across something while working on a historical research project that stands the test of time as good as I think many of the pieces in here do. So, you know, in a way, we're kind of a museum of sports writing, hopefully a living museum, but still preservation is part of our goal.
No, I just wanted to compliment Glenn for including the Bugs Bunny piece, and which, you know, I've never heard of USSMariner.com before. I never would have seen that in a million years. Maybe it was floating around on the web that I didn't see, but it was his ability to find things like that that really made it a delight for me to try to choose the right ones.
I have to credit the author for that one because he sent it to me, because even I wouldn't have stumbled across that on the Internet.
All right, since our listeners don't have the book in front of them, difficult as it must be, Glenn, give me a little synopsis of Bugs Bunny and sports.
Okay. Derek Zumsteg, a writer in Seattle, wrote about the Bugs Bunny episode in the Warner Brothers cartoon where Bugs plays baseball, and he wrote it completely straight, scientifically analyzing everything that takes place in the game. He never drops that conceit for a second and concludes that Bugs Bunny just might be, this obscure Bugs Bunny from this obscure cartoon footage, just might be the greatest baseball player of all time, and steroids is nowhere in the story at all.
Well, the Bugs Bunny piece, David, may have been a surprise, and I'm sure it was a delightful surprise because, after all, it is in the book. It made the cut. But when you accepted the guest editor's job, had you already decided on a lot of the stories that would be there?
No, I hadn't decided on any of them. It was all fresh for me. I mean, I've been writing my own book on a different subject for the last 2 years, and I'm totally obsessed in that period, and so wasn't paying as much attention as I usually do to this sort of writing. I had read probably the ones that are most familiar to people. You know, even though I'm a 30-year veteran of the Washington Post, I think that the New York Times Play magazine has some exceptional writing in it, and mm-hmm. I'd read most of those pieces beforehand. But, you know, probably 90% of them I hadn't read before.
Have any of your friends in the world of sports called or emailed to ask how you could possibly leave them out?
Maybe one has, but I haven't answered the call. Or maybe he was calling to say, how could you put that person in? I'm not quite sure, and I don't care. But no, I haven't gotten many complaints like that. And I don't know whether Glenn is maybe the repository for those sorts of calls or not, but I haven't.
I have an unlisted phone number for for reasons of that. But I rarely hear complaints from people as to why their stories were not picked. I mean, I think people are. What's gratifying to me is that I often hear from people who are absolutely thrilled that they were listed in the notable section. I heard from somebody just the other day who sent me a rather lengthy email describing the party that he and his family had with his young daughters and the congratulatory banner and the cupcakes they had just for being in the notable section. I think it's absolutely terrific because it tells me that the book really, really means something to people.
The notable section is sort of also receiving votes.
Yeah, sort of. It's kind of, nice try, almost, not quite, mm-hmm. keep going.
Mm-hmm. Often the best sports writing transcends sports, of course, and that can certainly be said of Let Us Now Raise Famous Men, Jeff McGregor's devastating portrait of Don King, which is also a portrait of the country that Don King so loudly celebrates. Glenn, how much of that story did you have to read before you knew that you would be sending it to David?
A sentence sometimes. literally sometimes I think the very best stories announce themselves that quickly. And Jeff's a terrific writer, and I think he had the absolute perfect take on Don King and the culture that surrounds him, because he let Don King and the culture that surrounds him do all the work. Mm. And what Jeff did was just pay really close attention and lay out what was happening. And I think that was just the perfect approach to Don King.
I agree. I think that sometimes a writer can be tempted to insert themselves as a character like Don King in a story like that, and you don't have to. And actually what sealed it for me was when he had Don King and Donald Trump together.
What a moment.
Wish he could have been there?
Just to let our listeners in on this, he describes Don King and Donald Trump standing together as two blimps filled with their own baloney sailing over the landscape of an America corrupt in its admiration for celebrity. It's quite gorgeous. I can't even do it justice off the top of my head, obviously. Bruce Wallace's short but powerful story about the death of a soccer player in Iraq also transcends sports, although obviously in a very different way. Manar Mudafar was killed by a stray bullet while he was playing soccer. Perhaps the most powerful detail in that story is that until he was killed, none of his teammates knew whether he was Shia or Sunni. They knew him as a teammate. It's a powerful comment on sports as a refuge, isn't it?
Well, I think that's, what sports does best is, at its best, breaks down barriers, makes things that matter elsewhere not matter. And, I thoroughly agree with you that when I found that out in the midst of that story, that sealed the deal, because there is that transcendent quality to sport. That's what draws us to it, and how could that be more, I suppose, better illustrated or more poignantly illustrated than in that anecdote?
One of the things that attracted me to that story is just this whole notion of the normality of life until suddenly it's not normal anymore. And that's true even in a place as horrifically war-torn as Iraq, that people are still playing soccer. They're still going about their daily lives in so many other thousands of ways that we don't think about here, because all we think about are the horrible IEDs and the deaths of people on all sides. So it captured at once both that notion that Glenn talked about athletes just being athletes, and also something about that moment of life when everything changes.
My guests are David Marinus and Glenn Stout, who are responsible for The Best American Sports Writing 2007. You're listening to Only a Game. David, you're an editor at The Washington Post, and you've written best-selling books set in sports. I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the writers represented in this book, but tell me about something that Glenn sent you that utterly surprised you.
Well, there were many of them. And we've already talked about Bugs Bunny. That was something that I'd never contemplated before, an ability to sort of take a what I would call a sabermetric approach to a cartoon character. It was in the first batch of stories. I immediately jumped on it and emailed Glenn, not knowing whether he liked it or not. And I said, you know, this story is amazing. It could use an editor. And it probably could, but as we both agreed, if there had been an editor, it maybe never would have been published. So you know, that's one of the amazing things about writing. Just let it go sometimes.
Glenn, back in 1998, when I was the guest editor, it seems to me that you said that if I didn't include J.R. Moringer's story, Resurrecting the Champ, you would override me and put it in the book anyway. I'm wondering if you feel that way about any of the stories that you sent to David this time around.
Well, I would have stomped my feet and whined if the Bugs Bunny story wouldn't have made it.
We keep coming back to the Bugs Bunny
story. I know.
Story.
Well, it's just such an anomaly, and it's just so terrific, and I really want people to read it. And the other story, which we also mentioned, was the Jeff McGregor story, which, you know, there's a handful of stories, and I think this is one of them that we've published over the years. William Knack's Pure Heart about Secretariat from the 1991 book. The Power and the Gory by Paul Solitaroff about somebody who used steroids, a bodybuilder, that just stand out from the get-go. And, you know, those are the ones where I sometimes just want to run up to people and, you know, open the book up, put it in their hands, and just say, start reading, because these are stories that are the reason that one learns to read, as far as I'm concerned.
The Best American Sports Writing 2007, published each year by Houghton Mifflin, is the responsibility of series editor Glenn Stout. Glenn, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks again, Bill.
And this year's guest editor is David Marinus. David, it was good talking to you again. Thanks very much.
Okay, Bill. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ho, 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 mate. Dave Downey of Perth, Australia, has won the World Santa Claus Championship, besting 30 contestants who engaged in activities such as reindeer racing and porridge eating. The competition was held in Sweden, which Mr. Downey must have found delightful. Asked how he practiced for the contest, Downey acknowledged that he replaced reindeer with sheep and kangaroos and said, "It's just a bit harder in the heat, that's all." Of Mr. Downey's winning performance, Elizabeth Landby, the official secretary of the Santa Games, said he was in third place most of the time, but he impressed the judges during the chimney climbing and jumped to first place. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, The Boxer and the Bard. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Two of the four very good teams in the National Football League played each other on Thursday night. Were you surprised at the outcome?
Not after Green Bay's Brett Favre got rammed into the ground and hurt his elbow and his shoulder and left the game in the hands of Aaron Rodgers, who played pretty well. But without Favre, there's absolutely no way Green Bay can stay with Dallas, and now the balance of power in the NFC has moved to Texas probably for the rest of the year.
Actually, before I asked you that question, I probably should have asked you whether you had seen the game.
I happen to have the NFL Network on the niche programming part of my cable package, so yes, I did get to see it. So I was not, you know, I did not have to, as was required by law this week, call my cable company and complain that I don't have the NFL Network.
Charlie, some people had theorized that Sean Taylor of the Washington Redskins had been killed by former associates when he was shot in his home last week. Now I gather that does not appear to be the case.
Well, at first blush, the detention of the first suspects at this point in the investigation seems to make this a random robbery, which means that all the people who leap to turn this into a sociology lesson are going to look really stupid if the initial impression of the case that the police have in Miami turns out to be the actual case.
In basketball news, the Knicks lost by 45 points to the Celtics on Thursday night and narrowly avoided posting their lowest point total in team history. This misery can't go on for much longer, can it?
I believe that somebody looking very much like me and probably wearing my underwear was sitting at this desk a few weeks ago saying the problem was Isaiah, but the team wasn't really that bad. You know what? The team is really that bad.
It certainly was Thursday night.
I think the most interesting thing of all, and I say this only as a television viewer, was that about three-quarters of the way through the game, the TNT broadcast determined that the play-by-play just wasn't worth a lick anymore and essentially turned their broadcast into Mystery Science Theater 3000, where they just had the game playing and they had the three hecklers from the TNT studio set commenting as the action went along. Charles Barkley went into the stratosphere almost immediately. It was great television.
This week, Reggie Miller, one of Thomas's former players, characterized the current Knicks as, quote, a league-wide joke. Was Miller pulling his punches?
He was underestimating that. I think they're probably an international joke at this point. I mean, it's not like this is the Charlotte Bobcats falling apart. People overseas know who the New York Knicks are.
Speaking of league-wide jokes, after suspending Philadelphia Flyers defenseman Randy Jones for a mere two games after a devastating and clearly illegal hit on the Bruins' Patrice Bergeron last month, the National Hockey League sent yet another weak message in the aftermath of Philly forward Scott Hartnell's hit on the Bruins' Andrew Alberts during Monday's game while Alberts was on his knees on the ice. Do you like the National Hockey League's VP of Hockey Operations reasoning for the more recent of the two-game suspensions?
Apparently, Alberts' head didn't go rolling down the ice, and that mitigated the offense to some extent. Look, we talked about this when the other incident happened. There have been several more incidents that don't involve the Bruins. The NHL has got to put a leash on the Philadelphia Flyers because they're not doing this to be a better hockey team. They're doing this to throw red meat to their fans. This check was delivered about 2 feet from a linesman, which means the Flyers don't care whether they get penalized for this. So the only thing you can do is penalize them harder. I'd take a home playoff game away from them. I really would. If they make the playoffs because they're doing this to fill their building, I would tell them, look, you're going to play a seven-game series and five of the games are going to be on the other team's ice.
The Davis Cup Final takes place this weekend in Portland, Oregon. Yes, it's always the Davis Cup Final somewhere. For those who want to watch all the action on television, have no fear. You're covered unless the matches are preempted by hockey games. I think I've got that right.
Yes, there's the Versus Network, formerly Outdoor Life Network, current home of the National Hockey League, has got three of the sessions. The Tennis Channel, which I don't believe even I have, has the rest of them. And, of course, the United States and Russia, this would have been a great rivalry 25 years ago, but now it sort of doesn't mean anything. But, once again, one of those teams will win and will begin the defense of its Davis Cup champion 11 minutes after the finals are over.
Well, the Versus Network may have an intriguing subplot to follow this weekend involving Russian team player Nikolai Davidenko. This week he turned over his phone records to the authorities who were investigating gambling activity during one of his matches. This is a sort of a James Bondish flavor here, isn't
it? Yeah, he has to turn over his personal phone records to the ATP enforcement police. And you just got to love people who would wear trench coats over, like, Bermuda shorts. But I have a very serious question, and I don't minimize the desire on anyone to win. Why is this guy on the Davis Cup team, considering he's being grilled for throwing matches? I mean, the Russians used to be a lot smarter than this.
We now know Penn State head football coach Joe Paterno's salary, and who'd have guessed it's so low?
To tell you the honest-to-God truth, $512,000 and some odd, that is low.
You don't suppose he has another revenue stream or seven coming in,
do you?
Well,
I'm sure he does, but I would definitely have taken the over. If you told me $512,000, I'd have taken the over on that bet.
The University of Nebraska football team finished 5-7 this year, which prompted interim athletic director Tom Osborne to take a drastic measure.
Yes, he conducted a very diligent desk-wide search and hired himself to be the interim coach. And anybody who thinks the interim coach is actually interim is fooling themselves.
The German company Deutsche Telekom, of which T-Mobile is a subsidiary, decided this week to stop sponsoring a professional cycling team because the company doesn't want to be associated with doping. I'm sorry, but where were these people for the past 25 years?
Well, did Deutsche Telekom...
I'm shocked.
I was about to say, did Deutsche Telekom President Louis Reyno chip in with a quote on this, or what? But would you love to be, like, at the Deutsche Telekom offices, like, last week? When the president went, you know, ach du lieber, doping!
Can this be true?
Why have I not have the memo?
Meanwhile, Don Garber, Major League Soccer's commissioner, this week characterized David Beckham's first year in the league thusly, David was really a home run for us. I probably am going to be very sorry that I asked, but would you care to comment on that assessment?
Oh, it's a long drive to left and it's bending just foul! I think that Commissioner Garber knows as much about baseball as I know about soccer.
In other pro soccer news, if the potential sale of the MLS champions, the Houston Dynamo, goes through, Oscar De La Hoya, winner of 6 pro boxing championships as well as an Olympic gold medal, will become co-owner of the team. Good career move for him?
I think, you know, he's a very good pitchman. He's managed to sell himself even though he's been an over-the-hill boxer for 9 years. He'd be a really good front man for the league. He loves to glad hand. He's widely connected in corporate America. That would be a good hire for the MLS, as they say.
Okay, surprise quiz, 2-part question. Of what liquid was Dr. Robert Cade, who passed away this week at the age of 80, speaking when he remarked, "I guzzled it and I vomited"? And part 2, why did Dr. Cade have no one but himself to blame?
Well, the answer to number 1 is goat sweat.
No.
The answer to number 2 is... that was one of the preliminary stages that eventually produced Gatorade, which, believe it or not, has an inventor. It's been around so long and it's become such a part of the language, it's hard to believe somebody actually had to invent it, that there wasn't a Gatorade tree with, you know, Gatorades hanging off it that you would squeeze it out of. But honest to God, Dr. Robert Cade invented Gatorade.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
It's baseball that we celebrate as something oddly pure in terms of how it represents America. And sure, we care about the other sports, that no one can deny. But baseball is so national, so pastime, so that I and most who write about our games consider it unique. But baseball has a darker side, and we need hardly seek for long before we find it, for it's plain as numbers make it, and baseball's full of numbers, which is why you cannot fake it. Pete Rose is baseball's greatest hitter. No one has more hits. But Pete Rose in retirement, my friend, he's been the pits. And though some feel the reasoning is badly flawed and lame, Pete Rose, the greatest hitter, may not make the Hall of Fame. And joining Rose in that distinction is the home run king, the man who leads the world in dingers. If the wrong guys sing, may find himself in jail instead of in the hallowed hall. And though the blame for that should probably hang upon us all, or those of us at least who didn't squawk as Barry grew, because we so enjoyed the mighty things that he could do, the fact remains that Barry, just like Pete, may never be enshrined in bronze in Cooperstown for all eternity. There is, I think, no other game of which the world can say its most prolific forces, guys who blew us all away, may never make the monument established for such folks. But Rose and Bonds are both instead the butts of ugly jokes. All could not be more dismal in that everlasting shrine where present deeds and those long past are said to intertwine, unless the ancient pitcher whose achievements we have sung turns out to be a villain, too. Say it ain't so, Cy Young. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
And you can tell all your friends at home, Gene Tunney's my teacher. Pencils all ready? Sweet are the uses of adversity. That's my favorite.
Thus speaks heavyweight champion Gene Tunney, played by Jack Weatherall in Tunney Shakespeare in Six Rounds, the play currently running at the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts. Playwright David Lane based the script on the fact that before his final fight in 1928, Gene Tunney did travel to Yale University to talk to students about the impact that Shakespeare had had on his life in and out of the ring. Tunney, who dropped out of school to help support his family when he was 15, was in the service when he first encountered Shakespeare. A fellow Marine gave him a copy of The Winter's Tale. Some of the sports writers who learned of the boxer's reading habits admired him, others ridiculed him. In any case, Tunney spoke at Yale once. The Tunney of this play delivers a series of six lectures, some of them spiced by timing the real Tunney might have had only in the ring.
In his autobiography, Dempsey said, "When I was in the ring and everything was going well, very little went on in my head. I didn't think because I had to concentrate."
Tunney Shakespeare in Six Rounds is a one-man show that's the dramatic equivalent of a fight that goes the distance. At 2.25 hours with a short intermission, the play tests the endurance of both Weatherall and his audience. In some of the more dramatic moments of the production, Tunney calls for a technician to dim the lights and comments on film of Jack Dempsey at work against Jess Willard, a fight Tunney studied in order to learn how he might defeat the champ.
Oh, that was it. Can we stop the projector? Rewind, please. That long swinging left hook was the single mightiest punch in the last 4 decades of boxing. It smashed Willard's right cheekbone into fragments. And when Dempsey knocked me down to the mat, let me tell you, there's a voice that says, "Stay down."
When they fought on September 27th, 1927, Tunney didn't stay down. Thanks perhaps to the fabled long count, which occurred at least in part because Dempsey failed to go immediately to a neutral corner after he'd decked his opponent, Tunney returned to his feet and outpointed Dempsey to retain the title. It was a result that disappointed many fight fans who'd come to appreciate Dempsey after his first loss to Tunney a year earlier. Much of the latter part of the play presents Gene Tunney as bitter at the fickle nature of fight fans and the public in general. As Weatherall presents him, Tunney was never embraced as other champions had been, never loved. Some sports writers who missed the dramatic violence that characterized Dempsey, even in defeat, dismissed Tunney as calculating and mechanical. A few days before I saw the play, Jack Weatherall spoke with me about the way the fictionalized Gene Tunney finds himself speculating about the rewards and consequences of achieving the goal he set for himself 7 years before he had the opportunity to meet Jack Dempsey in the ring.
He talks about what if that fight had just gone differently. Suppose he didn't end up as heavyweight champion. Was it that title that attracted people to him and gave him the, you know, the business contacts, the introduction to his wife and her family? And then there's it's a real examination of who am I? What is really of value in life?
Rare words, says Falstaff, a Shakespeare character with whom Gene Tunney would doubtless have been familiar, but rare words alone sometimes don't carry a play, especially a one-man play set up as a series of lectures. This explains why Jack Weatherall sees the production in Lowell as a work in progress.
The audiences here will be very informative for us, and we'll take their responses to heart, we'll develop the play, and hopefully we'll try to get it done in other places. It would be great to do it. He's lecturing at Yale, so it would be great to do it in New Haven. I'd eventually like to get it into New York.
Much as he's hoping, audiences at the Merrimack Theater will function as partners in honing Tunney's Shakespeare in six rounds, Wetherill is a bit apprehensive about what might happen if some of those who come to the play while it's running in this town rich in boxing tradition don't like what they see.
I'm nervous that if they don't like what I say about Tunney or about anybody else, that I might actually, you know, a lukewarm applause is something that I can deal with, but I'm not sure about meeting somebody at the stage door who wants to take me in the ring.
On the day I saw Wetherill play Tunney, there was no danger of offstage fisticuffs. Though somewhat uncomfortable with the violence of the filmed bouts, the Wednesday matinee audience was appreciative of Wetherill's performance. The applause at the end of the play was enthusiastic. Tunney Shakespeare in Six Rounds is scheduled to run through December 9th at the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Julian Saporiti, from Sam Sanders at Vermont Public Radio, and from Tim Allen at Wisconsin Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to check out our Gene Tunney photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Gene Tunney, who, while lecturing at Yale, discovered the secret of good teaching.
I figured out how to time these classes.
37 years in the classroom, and I've never gotten that right. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Hey, I got it.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.